not sick or struck dumb, or don't you know a kick when you see one can't quit? We're not done. We're gonna kick till the next one.
Imperial Diary, year 2024. Welcome to The Kick. This is a brand new movie podcast on the Now Playing Network, and although I now question its newness, because today we arrive at the capstone of our first theme miniseries, and I gotta stop doing that voice. That's right, for the last month, we've been on a Superior Sequels kick, where every guest has spotlit a sequel they prefer to the original movie, and our final destination, our topical hook, was the release of Dune 2, which is out right now, Dune Part 2, I should say. So we finally get to answer my incredulous question, is that a Superior Sequel? Here to help me make that call is my editor at Willamette Week, the assistant arts editor, if you want his proper title, and the man who brought the Bourne Supremacy to our first kick, Bennett Campbell Ferguson. Hello.
Hey, thanks for having me, Chance. And by the way, I think you might have upstaged Florence Pugh with that intro.
How high was the bar for upstaging her in this movie?
I mean, I'm a Florence stan, so pretty high, I'd say.
Okay, wow. Then you were legitimately being nice. I tend to like
legitimately,
her.
Yes.
I tend to like her work as well. So Ben, part of the reason that I wanted to have you on this episode is because I vividly remember standing in a parking lot with you, and it felt like at that point I knew that you were a big fan of director Denis Villeneuve's work. And I think you had just seen Dune 1, and I was just expecting this outpouring of BCF energy, and you were just like, it's a no thank you from me. And I was like, what? How is that possible? So ever since that moment, I have, you know, been interested on where Dune 1 kind of fails your Denis Villeneuve fandom. And so I thought this episode would be great because you could either do a total 180 with part two, or maybe you dig deeper on a negative viewpoint that is going against the critical grain. And I don't want to spoil it just yet because I do want to just ask you, is this a superior sequel, and give you the floor. But in like 60 to 90 seconds, what's your beef with Dune part one?
Well, to sum it up, I felt like it was a movie that was more interested in world building than storytelling. And often I think this happens with a long novel that is split in two for the film adaptation. It becomes clear watching the movie that while there's enough detail for two films, there's usually actually not enough story. And when I think about Villeneuve, I always think of like these great emotional moments, whether it's Amy Adams in Arrival, you know, realizing that her daughter is going to die, but embracing motherhood anyway, or Ana de Armas on the roof in the rain in Blade Runner 2049. That kind of grand emotion I felt was missing from Dune Part One, because it was really all table setting, honestly. And it felt like it was always gearing up for more interesting things to come, but those interesting things weren't then. So that was the problem with the first film, in my opinion.
Very well summarized. The Hobbit comes to mind as the ultimate example of...
Well, why split it in half when you can split it into thirds?
I got a radical idea. How about quarters? So
don't tell Peter Jackson. He'll try that again.
Yeah. You do the Silmarillion in 20 parts. So we're going to try to do the first 10 to 15 minutes relatively spoiler-free here, folks. But I don't imagine that we'll be able to keep that up for very long. So I will say we're going to make an honest attempt. Proceed at your own risk, though. This podcast will be better enjoyed by someone who has seen Dune Part 2 as much of America is doing this weekend. So Ben, feel free to jump in at any point if during all this context I'm going to give. But for every sequel in this series, I've been kind of running down what it repeats from its predecessor and what it changes. So in trying to do that exercise with Dune Part 2, asking what does it repeat, what does it bring back, the answer is you know, basically everything, because it's such an extremely direct continuity based sequel. It's the second half of Frank Herbert's iconic novel that Villeneuve and Eric Roth are adapting. So in the sense of saying, what does it repeat? It's kind of like saying, what does the second half of a book repeat from the first half? But you've got the same core cast. You got Timothée Chalamet as Paul Atreides, who is the wunderkind teenage son of the late Duke Atreides and the Bene Gesserit telepath and maybe clairvoyant Lady Jessica, played by Rebecca Ferguson. Paul and his mother, Lady Jessica, are now deep out in the northern deserts of the planet Arrakis. That's the planet that their house was given to steward in part one and oversee the extraction and export of the planet's spice. That didn't work out, and it was never intended to work out. When is a gift not a gift, as Baron von Harkonnen would say? So Arrakis here at the beginning of part two is back under the control of House Harkonnen. Paul and Lady Jessica are thought dead by most people, but they're actually just out with the indigenous Fremen in the desert, including the clan leader Stilgar, played by Javier Bardem, and Paul's, what should we call her, desert power trainer slash inevitable love interest, Shani, played by Zendaya.
I mean, that inevitable love interest, he literally spent an entire movie dreaming about her, which is like, this is no prophecy. He's just a typical teenage boy dreaming about a pretty girl. You know, very relatable in its way. Yeah,
there you go. There you go. And I believe the book and all the summaries of the book refer to Shani and Lady Jessica as concubines. Do they not?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I'm going to endeavor not to do that here today. So the Fremen are engaging in guerrilla warfare against the Harkonnen, and passions within that group are starting to boil over about whether Paul is in fact... the prophecy is called the Mahdi, but what is the title of the Messiah? Is it Mahdi? Is that right?
I mean, there's so many different titles, because Muad'Dib and Usul are names that he's given, but then he's also hailed as like the Lisan al-Ghaib, so... God, it's a lot of titles to sort through.
Anyway, is Paul the long-foretold savior of the Fremen? Stilgar and Lady Jessica are like, uh-huh, yep. And Shani and Paul himself are like, we're not really sure. So that's more synopsis than anything, obviously. But if we're literally asking what is Dune 2, repeat from Dune 1, sandworms, spice, visions, all six technical categories that it won for the 2021 Oscars: sound design, Greg Fraser's cinematography, Joe Walker's editing, Patrice Vermette's production design, Hans Zimmer's score, I would argue are as good or better here. And since we're not really evaluating quality yet, I will just say it's extremely consistent. One of the things it repeats is a vision from Villeneuve that invokes, I'm paraphrasing my own review here, but a Pharaoh's sense of scale and a tectonic plate's sense of sound. That is all to say, if you've seen the first movie, you know the aesthetics, performance styles, and soundscapes of this one.
Sonics that touch bone marrow, I recall.
Is that what I said?
Gentleman writing.
Thank you for printing that. So what does it add or do differently? Some characters. So while Paul and the Fremen are out in the desert organizing a revolution, back at the imperial city of Arrakeen, melting marshmallow man Baron von Harkonnen, played by Stellan Skarsgård, is strongly considering turning over all of his Fremen genocide plans to his even meaner nephew, Fade Rotha, played by Austin Butler, who is an expert at sneering despite having no eyebrows and indiscriminately slicing throats. And double meanwhile, we get our first glimpse of the imperial infrastructure surrounding this story, because we meet the Emperor's daughter, Princess Irulan, played by Florence Pugh, who keeps an audio diary and speculates about the fall of House Atreides and whether Paul is really dead and what's going on there. We re-meet the Reverend Mother, Gaius Helen Mohiam? Maybe. With that pronunciation. Played by Charlotte Rampling. We learn more about
that. I didn't even remember her name. I was just like, oh yeah, it's Charlotte Rampling, the ruler of this matriarchal sect that controls everything.
It's Charlotte Rampling dressed as a beekeeper at a funeral. And we also meet the frail emperor, played by Christopher Walken. And then I think the other big change or evolution worth mentioning here is just how this movie treats the Muad'Dib savior prophecy. Because that's you could argue that that is the core of the movie, in addition to some badass action. It's a topic of near constant discussion and conflict. And I would argue that this movie gets both like cryptic and forceful about the power of this messianic prophecy, because different characters have different views on Paul's fate and the Fremen's fate, and then these views just kind of slam into each other to the extent of, like, does it matter if it's true? So this movie's idea of the hero's journey is both up for a lot of debate and completely bowled over by what the movie must be done. I would say, like, imagine a Socratic circle run by 150-ton sandworms. There's a lot to talk about in theory, but at the end of the day, the chairs are going to get fucking knocked over.
It's breathtaking. When you see sand here, imagine water. If you dive in, you can't reach the bottom.
You dive in?
Yes, it's called swimming.
I don't believe you.
In the shadows of Arrakis lie many secrets. But the darkest of them all may remain. The end of House Atreides.
Your father didn't believe in revenge.
What if Paul Atreides were still alive?
Have you ever had a dream about your first ride?
Don't try to impress anyone. You're brave, we all know that. Be simple. Be direct.
Ben. Is this a superior sequel?
Yes, it is.
I didn't know what you were going to say. I'm glad to hear you say it. Why do you think?
I think that this is a movie that gets to the core of what is interesting about Dune as a novel, because if you just read the first half of the book, just as if you watch only the first film, you might get the idea that Dune is very similar to the things it inspired, like Star Wars or Avatar, which I love, but I appreciate that Dune is something very different in that it's not really about the rise of a hero. It's arguably about the rise of a tyrant. And this is the movie that commits to that journey with such weird, you know, twisted, horribly beautiful grandeur. I found it to be kind of an ecstatic experience, you know, getting lost in that world and taking that journey in terms of the imagery, in terms of the emotions. It's the kind of thing you hope for from movies, honestly.
Sure. And a big turnaround from you.
Yeah, I mean, but this is the fun thing about movies. Always, like, being surprised. Like, I assumed that I would love the first Dune because I love Denis Villeneuve, and I did it. And I came into this one with pretty low expectations given the first film. And then really from the minute of that, you know, Imperial Diary monologue at the beginning and the montage, there was just an instant sense that I'm back in good hands. Like, just the film felt like everything was clicking into place and flowing in this elegant, you know, beautiful, mesmerizing way, honestly.
So why don't we just start by shouting out a set piece or two, Ben? What was your favorite action scene?
I think it does have to be the first sandworm riding scene.
It's unbelievable.
With Paul. Yeah, it's so good. I mean, the way that it's done with him, like, leaping atop the worm, and at first he's kind of just lost in this maelstrom of dust and sand and wind, and slowly as he gains his footing, you get both these, like, epic shots of him, you know, standing atop this worm, and it's kind of rocky, rigid skin, but also like these little details, like his foot on the worm and just like his heel slowly touching down as he gains control. And that juxtaposition of, you know, massive scale, but really fine, fine detail. It's like, that's what blockbuster cinema should be about and so rarely is.
Totally. Yeah, I mean, that one is fantastic. I would also shout out the scene of Paul and Shawnee bringing down the hovercrafts. The, what do they call those? The dragonfly ships?
I think the Thopters.
There we go.
I do think of them as dragonfly ships, though. Yeah. the flippy wings, you know?
And, you know, there's this sort of like a video game-esque first-person shooter thing of like them peeking around and like trying to shoot it down while Paul goes to kind of, you know, lure the gunner away. But the part of that that I felt was just like ecstatic is there's this moment, this kind of suspended moment where Shawnee has shot down the ship, but it hasn't hit the ground yet. And Zendaya is just like running in a horizontal line evenly across the screen. And she's like laughing hysterically. And the ship like finally hits the ground behind her, and it's just such a joyful, badass way to end that scene. The triumph of guerrilla fighting.
Yeah. Well, she gets some of the best action stuff. I mean, there's what will, I assume, ultimately be quasi-legendary, this long take where the camera is behind her during the final battle and just following her as she takes out all these guys. And watching that, I was thinking, people don't think of Denis Villeneuve as like a great action director, but that's like John Wick level shit right there. I mean, or at least approaching that area.
I mean, I'm probably a bigger Sicario person than you, but the fight at the border was like, you don't know which SUV the guys are in. Like, I really think of that as pretty amazing use of like tension and action.
Did you feel like there's like a visual connection between this movie and Sicario? Because like seeing all the Harkonnen guys and like their scuba type gear in the desert at the beginning, like I thought of the opening of Sicario and the black uniforms.
Totally.
And everything.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. The kind of frightening armored up anonymity of those dudes.
Yes.
And a cool contrast as well of just like the movie does such a good job sometimes with like the weight of its action, especially like in that sandworm scene. And then, so it's really, really eerie when the dudes in the heavy armor just float up the side of the cliff.
Yeah.
It's a fun contrast. Okay. How about, is Timothy Chalamet better in this movie? Cause I know that I think we both struggled with him in part one.
Totally. I think he is better, and I still think he's an actor of pretty limited range, to be honest. Like, I often have this feeling, and I had it with Wonka as well, where you feel he's like sort of straining to summon the charisma that the role is demanding. And I feel a little bit of that in Dune Part 2, but I also think he rises to the challenge pretty admirably. And there's always the acid test of, when a character gives a big war speech, does it make you want to follow them into battle? Kenneth Branagh in Henry V, yes. Sam Worthington in Avatar, yes. Timothy Chalamet in Dune Part 2, yes, surprisingly. I mean, you know, listening to him rant about how, like, none of you can best me, I have to say, watching that scene, I was like, okay, I know this is evil. I know he's becoming like a little fascist who's going to lead all these people into a holy war. But, and you know, whether this is a good thing or a bad thing is a conversation, but I did find myself, you know, getting lost in that moment and admiring the force with which he was able to command the screen in a way that honestly, I never dreamed he could.
I think the movie, I agree that the movie like gives him those opportunities. I think I still struggle with like him not having the physical presence to carry off the domination required in those scenes. I feel like he's kind of slight. I mean, he is slight and that's cool, but like you know, I don't know how you, he's not exactly like one of the Raid actors in terms of like how how quick he is when he's in a small stature like that. I would also say there's a little bit of Nick Cage screaming, where he just kind of like goes to like Bad Cage, where he just dials it up at random times, where he's just talking about the Muad'Dib prophecy and that it's been used to control the Fremen people. And he's like, that's not hope. And his mom's like, well, you, actually, Timothy, and he's like, that's not hope. And I don't love that acting style, but based on where the character is going, maybe I'll feel differently about his iciness when we get there. Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, that makes total sense. I think that's totally fair. But I have to say, now that you brought up Nicolas Cage, I'm like, who could he play in one of these movies? You know, he would have made a good emperor if Christopher Walken didn't do it.
I'll spoil one of the joke questions from later. Walken as the emperor, it's very good visual casting, because Walken is sort of like regal at this age and he just has the highest hair in the world. But he, you know, I don't know if listeners know this, Christopher Walken kind of sounds like Christopher Walken. So there are moments where he's just like, my dear daughter. And it's like, oh, okay, this, the emperor's from Queens. but Cage as that role, it, you know, could be equally distinct.
I think so. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think one of the pleasures of this movie is like seeing Christopher Walken walk into this weird sci-fi world and just kind of say weird sci-fi words, but in a Walken-ish way, like, you underestimate my Santa car. You know? It's like, yeah, yeah, you underestimate his Santa car. I get it.
Yeah, know? Have to. So we also have this expansion in Dune 2, because Zendaya's, you know, is she in the last 15 minutes of part one? 10 minutes? She's barely in it.
I mean, she's really like an almost Terrence Malick style fragment.
Yes.
In that movie, who keeps like fading in and out of his consciousness. So yeah, I think this is like the first proper Zendaya performance we've gotten in one of these movies.
So you get this kind of parallelogram of four of our most promising rising stars in Hollywood: Chalamet, Austin Butler, Florence Pugh, and Zendaya, all people in their 20s, all, you know, if anyone is going to save movie stardom in American films, it's, these are four of the candidates.
Yeah.
What do you think of this, these performances, or how they're used in the movie, Ben? Good, bad, the other, anywhere you want to take it?
This might sound like damning the acting with faint praise, but I don't feel like there's one great standout performance that kind of knocks your socks off. And there doesn't have to be, honestly. Like I don't think, you know, all movies have to have a performance that kind of, you know, peeks out of the fabric. I think it's okay to have movies where the actors are all kind of working to create the fabric together, but definitely there's no one who's like Ana de Armas and Blade Runner, or
right,
Amy Adams in Arrival, or Jake Gyllenhaal in Prisoners. Honestly, there's not that performance that makes you go, wow. Except I would say for Léa Seydoux, who comes into the frame for this very, you know, dreamy, weird, sinister, kinky sequence that I think kind of stops the whole movie in its tracks. And she certainly, I think, gives the most interesting performance for my money in this movie.
Yes, she's part of the Bene Gesserit order. I guess we're pretty far. Are we into spoilers yet, folks?
Let's do it. Spoilers.
I think we got to transition over to spoilers. Yeah, she's like the representative of the Bene Gesserits, and she comes to Arrakis and is just like, we need to make sure we firmly have our talons into Fade Rotha as he takes over the Harkonnen operations. And she's just like, what what does our file say about his sexual proclivities? And it's like, well, likes to be humiliated, so we'll start there.
He killed his mother, so it has to be like a young woman who comes
Right.
and seduces him. And for the sake of atmosphere, the whole thing is on this planet with a black sun, which basically means the whole thing looks like it's in super high contrast, black and white, and
Yes.
just kind of looks generally awesome.
It's a crazy like visual tone shift because you know the rest of the movie is
Yes.
just like so loves orange and natural light and sandstone and you know temples. So yeah, when we go to I don't know, yeah, monochromatic, almost anime, it's a wild choice. Is that a different it is
Yeah.
a different planet?
Gedi Prime is the name of the
How about
planet.
that? I must say I think I wanted more possibly for all of them to do if this was
Yeah.
just my wish list here. I mean like Princess Irulan, Florence Pugh is like barely in the movie. I honestly she gets the Zendaya treatment from part one where
Yeah.
you're just like, well, this is a character we're meeting now because she'll play a big role later.
Well, that's kind of an interesting thing that the first movie starts with Zendaya narrating, the second movie starts with Florence Pugh narrating. Always you begin with the perspective of the women, which feels very fitting in this universe, these mythos where everything is controlled by the matriarchal figures who are kind of using these masculine brutes to accomplish their will. And there is a certain symmetry to it, I
Totally.
think.
And says something about like the really the bird's eye view by which a lot of the storytelling kind of gets done ultimately.
Yeah.
How about the comedy of Javier Bardem?
Oh,
Good for you, bad for you. What do you think?
good. Yeah. I mean, I love how he's able to come into these, dour films, whether it's this or Skyfall or Mother, and just kind of be, impish, dashing Javier Bardem. And that moment when he's like, see, he said he's not the Messiah, so that proves he is. Like, I mean, that's really funny and goofy, but it's also, I think, pretty good satire of a certain kind of obsessive person of unshakable faith.
Sure, it's like some Life of Brian shit brought on by
Yeah.
Stilgar here. And I do like I think some of his moments and Rebecca Ferguson's best moments are from before she drinks the water of life and becomes a Reverend Mother. Like they have that thing of where he's just like, don't throw up. Don't it would be an insult to our people and to biology if you waste water by letting your morning sickness make you throw up on the sand. And it's a fun interaction.
Which what a great scene, by the way. Like, it kind of reminds me of I remember, actually, not to make this a reborn podcast, but I remember Manola Dargis writing about how that scene in The Bourne Identity, where Franca Potenta sees the dead landlady and vomits, she said that scene was so important because it established kind of the real stakes of those movies. Like, people are going to behave like human beings. And in Dune, yeah, if you see a bunch of dudes having the water sucked out of their body, I'd vomit after I saw that. I mean, Jesus, like, it's a horrifying thing to watch, even though it's, necessary for the survival of our heroes.
Sure, absolutely. Okay, we're gonna proceed right into spoilery questions here because that seal has already been broken. I tried, folks. Ben, when I was asking you to anticipate Dune 2, the thing that gave you hope is that this was the more interesting half of the book, which I think you've already addressed.
Yeah.
Can we say a little more about the ways in which this movie makes good on the more interesting half of the book?
Yeah, I think for me it all comes down to the moment in the end where he says to the emperor, "You'll be lucky to keep your head. They'll take your daughter's hand in marriage." And honestly, to me, that was the most memorable moment in the book, because it's the moment that solidifies Paul's transformation from a kind of innocent, idealistic kid into a very pragmatic, warlord-like figure. who will do whatever it takes to get the job done and solidify his power and, you know, attain his vengeance, even and especially if it means going against what his heart wants. And it was so thrilling to see the movie embrace that journey without apology and without, you know, giving him some kind of out, like, oh, well, he's really not that bad. It's like, no, he spends the entire movie saying, I don't want to lead these people into a holy war. They have to lead themselves. And in the end, he's like, fuck it. The only way to get revenge is to lead them into a holy war. So let's do it. And I appreciate the movie going all in on that.
I hear what you're saying. And I like that you say it makes that character shift without apology. As someone who has not read the book, like Rebecca Ferguson, Ben, I have not read Dune.
That's right.
And Rebecca's the only person that makes me feel good about being ignorant in that respect.
By the way, anything Rebecca Ferguson says immediately is like a gift to humanity. She is an amazing actor and an equally amazing celebrity.
That video of her explaining why she's wearing the eye patch in MI7 because she can't wink, I watch that all the time.
Oh, same. Yeah, legendary.
It makes the transition without apology. Can I argue that it sort of makes it without much clarity? And maybe this is my read, too, on... I don't think that Chalamet and Zendaya have any romantic chemistry together.
Oh, I totally agree.
I don't think that they're sexy together, but I also don't think they're, like, puppy love fun together. They seem like they're the only people of a certain age, and he's eager to learn, and they share a tent.
Yeah.
And when you don't have that... either your heartstrings or your desire strings being pulled in that more like, let me be a normal person and have a normal relationship direction. And instead the story is just kind of, you know, forcefully going down a prescribed road of fate where he's just like, my mom's going to drink the water and I'm going to drink the water and they're going to, and that's going to make me die. Except, Shawnee here is part of another prophecy about healing tears, and I'm going to wake up, and then, as you said, I'm going to do what I said I wouldn't do. I don't know if the movie, like, I feel sometimes that it is caught between two kinds of storytelling, and one is that real, like, bird's eye view, ancient Greek tragedy, like, this guy is going to become, this guy who's been given everything is going to continue this kind of monarchical legacy of like these warring houses, and he's never actually going to be a real person. But then I would argue that sometimes that robs the movie of what to me feels like any genuine catharsis, whether that be like for his relationships or even like the final siege of the city on this, when the sandworm is involved, it's breathtaking. But yes. I'm still like, I'm watching Paul like rip through people to get to the emperor and get to the baron, and I'm not sure, am I watching the emptiness of someone else's pathos at a massive scale, but pathos that I am not meant to share? I'm just not sure whether the, like, if this story is being told from a Bene Gesserit bird's eye view level, if I am ever on the level of characters in a way that feels like a discernible feeling to me.
That's a really interesting question, because definitely some of what you're saying really resonates for me, because there are parts of the movie where I feel like I know the idea they're conveying, but they could convey it in a way that just had more aplomb or more naturalism or humanity. I think to me, there is a catharsis in a kind of messed up sort of way, because as horrible as it is, I do find it cathartic to sort of see him embrace the prophecy. And of course, one of the big spoilery revelations, which actually, if they had followed the book, would have occurred in the first film, but they decided to save it, is that Lady Jessica is Baron Harkonnen's daughter, and therefore, you know, she and Paul are Harkonnens.
Right.
And the moment when he says, we're Harkonnens, we're going to win by being Harkonnens, and there is a kind of awful and yet inevitable satisfying thing about seeing him not run from that. And I think the other thing I think is interesting, like you mentioned the siege is such a, you know, showstopper of an action scene, and yet Villeneuve almost seems like he breezes by it. Like when we get into the final scene with the Emperor and all the negotiations and single combat between Chalamet and Austin Butler, you know, that scene is so long and meaty and textured. You feel like, oh, that's the scene he really wanted to get to. And a lot of times it seems like he's eager to kind of get past the violence, which led me, you know, thinking back to like his early career and how, you know, one of his breakout movies was Polytechnique, a movie about a mass shooting. And I feel that even though he can direct a great action scene, it almost feels like he's a director who feels that using violence is distasteful. And especially if you're using it for entertainment, that maybe explains why he certainly kind of breezes past certain things or elements where you could get like a big spectacular payoff. Like the Dave Bautista, Josh Brolin showdown, when that arrived, I was like, yes, you know, boss fight. And then Josh Brolin stabs him and it's like over in 1 second. And at first I was like, oh man. But then I was like, oh wait, the movie wanted to deny me that payoff. Like that's the point in a way, I think. I mean, that's the whole tangent, but.
No, it is a fairly bloodless universe in general. And I hear what you're saying on some level. And I do think you're right, definitely in the sense of it goes to his directorial taste, where he is just like, how can I engineer or cleverize this so it's not too exploitative or too just what it is on its face. But I have to signal out the Gurney Glasu, the Bautista Brolin fight. Like that you have wanted those two to smash head to head since the first moment in Dune 1 where Gurney's like describing the Harkonnens and he's just like, they're brutal. And then Dave Bautista basically does the same like growl when he's just like beheading people and screaming, and you're like, someday these two are gonna meet. And Denis just like sets the table for 5 hours, and then it's just like a knife you don't even see. And I'm like, buddy, you have overthought. Of all the things you could subvert, don't subvert this. This is why I'm here. It was frustrating to me.
I totally get that. But at the same time, I kind of love the way he messes with the audience with that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Like even when it comes down to Chalamet and Butler, and you don't even see the knife like stabbed into him, it's it is dissatisfying, but I kind of love that he's sort of tricking us into thinking we're gonna get something that we're never gonna get. Like it feels very impish in a way.
It is kind of impish. That climactic trial by combat there is the best part of that scene, is the light coming in through the window behind them, just like the kind of T-shaped window out to the capital city, is just like, again, like this production design is amazing.
Yeah.
But should the production design be the show stealer in a knife fight between the two most important, not the two most important characters, but the guys you've wanted to see go head to head? I don't know.
Well, it reminds me of something I heard on a podcast where two critics were saying, like, Villeneuve's films, they almost feel like a series of cathedrals.
Ah.
Like, he made a film called Arrival, And the movies always seem to be about arriving in these grand spaces. And yeah, like some of the lighting at the end and the silhouettes, I thought back to the Vegas scenes and
totally
Blade Runner.
Totally.
And it's like, oh yeah, these grand entrances into these, you know, cavernous, you know, beautifully filigreed worlds. You see the obsession there. Again, like you said, consistent to the last.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Lady Jessica has a quote about the visions that she has and the visions that her son has. She says, "You cannot see the future without seeing the past."
Yeah.
And I get the feeling at the end of two that I got at the end of one that, you know, if you want to accuse it of just being Craven sequel baiting, I suppose you could do that. But it also does feel like something more experimental, maybe, where this movie is again like really not meant to be self-contained. Like there's so yeah. many things that entirely gesture to what must be coming in a third movie. So Ben, I want to ask, like, what do you make of this kind of sequel fashioning? Does it feel like a super standard approach of just like, no, this is the second half of a book, easy, or something more of a higher reach? What do you think?
It's a good question. I think that it feels like, weirdly, for all of what's unresolved, it feels like its own sort of self-contained thing to me. And I often criticize the sort of endlessly franchisable model of Hollywood, and I have my frustrations with that, but I've never objected to cliffhanger endings. You know, what I object to is a lack of completion in terms of character journeys. Like The Empire Strikes Back obviously is just, you know, one third of a story, but so much happens within that third that hits a kind of resolution. It's like by the end, you know, Han and Leia have declared their love, you know, Luke has lost his innocence. There is a solidness to the place where that movie finishes. And I think in a weird way, there's a solidness to the way this one finishes too. And the promise of war, I honestly think it could all end here because that's where the book ends. You know, the book ends with just, that's how it happens. You know, this is how, you know, horrific genocidal regimes are born, you know, the end. Of course, you know, there are a zillion other books, but, you know, and apparently, I haven't read this, but apparently one of them, Paul's son, actually turns into a sandworm. So,
what?
You know.
Is that in Children of Dune?
Yeah, I don't know which book it's in, but, you know, this stuff all started out in the 60s. So, what are you going to do?
Yeah. You're going to take mushrooms and imagine a child turning into a sandworm.
Oh, hell yeah. Yeah.
What were you about to say? Go ahead.
Well, I was thinking back to when we talked about Bourne, and as you've asked like other guests on the podcast, like what kinds of, you know, sequels are there? Is it a retrenchment? Is it, you know, a kind of revisionist take? And I feel like, you know, more and more, and I rewatched the first Dune before seeing the new one, and the first Dune, you know, felt like a weird dream to me. And this to me like feels like a better, sharper, deeper, more provocative continuation of the dream. But it's funny because, you know, had I not known that it was one book split in two, I think I probably would have said, oh, this is just The Empire Strikes Back. It's the kind of darker, more morally ambiguous version of it. But kind of knowing it's one half of a whole, you think about it in a different way, you know?
Sure. If I could push back a little bit, I would say that the characters of Princess Irulan, the Reverend Mother that Leo Sidhu is playing, the flash forward to Aaliyah, the unborn, Paul's unborn sister, there's just a lot. The revelation about Lady Jessica being Baron von Harkonnen's daughter, there's just a lot of things that to me are just like not, they're introduced here, but I don't really see them as like being part of the story that I just saw. Like they only make sense to me as something that are part of the next story. In a way that is maybe more like more ambitious perhaps than like say some of the superhero connectivity we're used to seeing, because that's more like, well, you'll get your kicks when we show you this person and promise that they'll be in it later. Like, I don't get any kicks by seeing Lea Seydoux. Well, I mean, I do, but that character doesn't mean anything to me. It's just like a person of some supposed import who I assume will play a greater role later. And there's just like a lot of that in this movie that all feels like a flash forward that I find both like kind of daring but kind of frustrating. Because when you describe Empire Strikes Back, like every character we meet in Empire Strikes Back plays plays the role that they were meant to play in the film Empire Strikes Back. And I think there are like maybe four people in this movie who don't quite do that. And even the Harkonnen Lady Jessica parental revelation, those are not characters we've ever seen interact. We've never really seen. The only time we've ever seen a Harkonnen and a Atreides in the same room in the first one was like pretty much dead Leto. So I'm just like, even the meaning of this fairly expository revelation will maybe be clearer to me later. And I'm, again, interested but frustrated at that. I find it very complicated, a very complicated kind of storytelling that is like trying to deliver like a rah-rah, yes, they did it, while also being a multi-level, multi-timelined, all things are possible, but actually fate only makes one thing possible. I just feel like it's juggling a lot of different kinds of storytelling.
No, it is. And for me, I think just the way it's put together and written and the way the story flows with, I think, a kind of remarkable, elegance, given like how dense it is and how much, mythology they're cramming in there. But there's no doubt that like a lot of what you're saying is on the money. And I mean, maybe part of the problem is that this is what happens when a fanboy gets a hold of his favorite book. And I think the fact that he is a fan is part of, what, makes his iteration of this world so rich and enveloping and visually detailed, but definitely in terms of characterization and pacing, I wouldn't say that this movie is as sharp and clear and artfully sort of welded into place in the way that like Arrival is. No.
Right. Can I ask you a goofy question?
Please, yeah.
So the just jaw-dropping action scene of Paul riding the sandworm for the first time, it was like one of those like kind of out-of-body theatrical experiences where I realized, like, I was like, oh, how long has my mouth been open? 30 seconds? 60 seconds? I think I just realized I was physically reacting to it in a way that I didn't know was happening in the moment. It really takes some doing to ride that sandworm, right?
Oh, absolutely.
We see later in the movie that like in entire communities of Fremen, children, the elderly, are all riding the worm. How the hell do they do that?
Well, I have an answer for you, Chan.
What is it? Magic of the movies?
I believe that when it happens, the Fremen all get together, whoever's in charge says, children, elderly, babies, whoever, you're all going to ride this worm. And they're like, how? We can't all climb up there. It's hard enough for one person to. And then Stilgar says, yes, but you're going to do it because it's cool.
Okay.
So that's my facetious way of saying, I think you're right. It's the magic of movies. Like, when I saw that question, I was like, yeah, you're right. I love that. And it was such a great image, like an entire community atop this thing as it's, blazing through the desert and, clouds of dust. I was like, yeah, it's cool, but I can't claim that it makes sense. I mean, Lord, no.
it's just dumb. Some of them, maybe I'm misremembering this, but don't they have like tents, little shelters and stuff set up on top of the worm?
Rebecca Ferguson is in that like giant basket thing, like peering out through a curtain, which one of the best shots in the movie, by the way.
I like it. All right, Ben. I don't know if I did this segment with you last time, but it's called Truth or Trivia. Trivia is what it is. And truth is I ask you to make a somewhat difficult answer, a maybe difficult question about movies. What do you want to do, truth or trivia?
Truth.
What do you think is the best movie scene ever set in the desert?
Oh, God, that's...
Take your time.
What I was about to say that's hard, but that's actually pretty easy
for me.
It has to be the Twin Suns setting in Star Wars.
Can I ask you some trivia questions?
Bring it on.
You know what country Rebecca Ferguson's from?
Sweden, right?
Easy. Wow. Okay. I just feel like she just does British so well.
Oh, she does British amazingly well. I thought she was British for years. Like, when I found out, I was thinking, like, Sweden? Like, really? I just think of her as this very elegant, aristocratic English woman, but...
Side note to that.
Yeah.
Austin Butler as Fade Rotha is definitely doing a Swedish accent to try and sound like Stellan Skarsgård. And it really... A prior guest, Molly Henry... was like thought Bill Skarsgård was Fade Rotha because of the implication that it was Stellan's son and he was trying to sound like Stellan Skarsgård. So
God, now that I think about it, that would have been way better casting.
I'm not here to talk shit, although, you know, why else have a podcast? I'll give me but Bill Skarsgård over Austin Butler any day, I'll say that.
Yeah. I didn't think Austin Butler was bad. I mean, I enjoyed his weird, guttural voice more than his Elvis voice.
Sure. biologists have speculated, Ben, which is how all good sentences start on this podcast. Biologists have speculated that millions of years ago, sandworm-type creatures lived in the ocean. In the area of Taiwan. And that, you know, leads one to think, like, could there be sandworms? Why? This is putting your biology speculation to the test. Why could sandworms not live on land? If such creatures did in fact live in the ocean, why could they never actually live on land? Thoughts?
Oh.
Is this even trivia?
Wait. If they lived in the ocean, why could they never live on land? I mean, did they have gills or something? Could they not breathe air? I mean, obviously the sandworms in the movie breathe sand or something.
Obviously.
They have sand gills. I don't know.
That is one of the reasons. You got it. They could never be that size on land because... You would need to, like, a creature that size would need to be able to take in air in some more, like, concentrated or acute way. And also, they're invertebrates, and invertebrates can't be that big on land. They wouldn't be able to, they wouldn't be able to propel themselves.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, love it.
I thought that was fun.
I feel like this is atoning for the C I got in biology in high school, so.
Perfect. Hearing me probably with mistakes regurgitate speculative biology from the University of Utah, that's bringing it all back.
By the way,
yeah,
interesting Denis Villeneuve's obsession with creepy crawlies. You know, prisoners, a bunch of snakes in a box.
Yeah,
enemy, the giant spider arrival, the heptapods.
Yeah.
And now sandworms and like little bugs crawling all over Stellan Skarsgård's corpse.
Yes.
He loves his like nasty crawly things. It's becoming a signature, I think.
That's true, but you're right, like quite quietly, like you don't think of him as like a, you know, a Stephen Sommers kind of director. Ben, I think this brings us to the end. Is there anything else about Dune 2 you feel must be said? Anything we didn't cover?
No, I think we covered it. You know, this was a fun journey to Arrakis and Gaty Prime and worlds beyond. I love talking about this movie with you.
I feel much the same. And I'm glad that it so clearly was a superior sequel for you. That I think it would have been, I would have been willing to live with it, but I think it would have been weird if you were like, no, it's not a superior sequel. But you were emphatic. And thus the first series, I think, is a success.
Yeah, it's great to end on a high note. And, you know, it's always more fun to love a movie than to hate a movie. Not that the hating isn't fun, too, but, you know.
It's more fun. And it's good for the reputation of film critics to like movies, I think. To loudly like movies. Anything you want to plug or direct people to, Ben?
Yeah, you can follow me on Twitter at THO Bennett. I'll post my favorite films of the year and some like the nominees should have been goodies before the Oscars. So check it out.
Cool. Yeah, Oscars next week or at the end of the week in which this is releasing. That's exciting. What is your most passionate rooting interest at this year's Oscars?
Well, it's got to be Oppenheimer, just to see Nolan finally get the gold after, in my mind, being denied it many years when he should have won. But I don't know, there are a lot of like interesting races, too. Like visual effects, I think, is really interesting. Like, what if the creator wins or Godzilla minus one wins, or what if Napoleon wins? It's the most nominated movie in that category. So I'm not entirely writing off a kind of like 1917 level upset for VFX. I'm excited for the show.
I bet there is some momentum in that guild about like what was achieved in Godzilla Minus One with so little money and how good it looks. And, you know, the bodies being increasingly international, that could be a fun upset.
Yeah. Oh, totally agree. Yeah. I mean, it's just amazing that movie costs like what, 15 million and looks better than most 200 million movies made in the US. I mean,
really says something about how these resources are used and if they're being used by the most creative people or not.
I fear we're making Ant-Man cry somewhere, but that'll just have to be the way it is.
I'll still sleep at night. Ben, I guess this is a good place to announce that our next kick is sports romances leading up to the release of Challengers at the end of April, and you're gonna come on and talk Point Break. Yeah.
Oh, I can't wait. I'm ready, bro.
This is your fucking wake-up call, man.
I can't pull off surfer slang. I'm sorry, but it was just right there.
You have weeks to prepare.
Exactly.
So, all right, man. We'll see you soon, and thanks for the convo.
Thank you, Chance.